S-I-P-O-O, San Francisco, where we're burning bad.
Shiba Shiba. Shiba Shiba. Shiba Shiba.
Let me in.
Shiba Shiba.
I want to be closer to you.
Shiba Shiba.
Open up your soul.
Shiba Shiba.
Let me find that part of you. The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your
mind. Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. And if it's the first Monday of the month, we want you to understand something. The Wonderfest people are always kind enough to send us over fabulous scientists to talk about science and answer questions for people like me who maybe didn't have the best science learning growing up. And so then I can ask a real person my questions and they can try and explain it so that I can understand it. Here, the science envoy du jour is Savas Marku. Welcome.
Good morning, and thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. So tell me a little bit about your science background. Like, when did you first discover that you were drawn to the sciences?
That's a very interesting question. So I think I cannot pinpoint an exact point in time where that happened.
Mm-hmm.
I was very lucky to have a grandfather who was a civil engineer when I was a young child.
Oh.
So he would point out a lot of things about, you know, the color of the sky and the clouds and how things worked.
Uh-huh.
So he would talk about, for example, how a boiler worked.
Okay.
And it was just intriguing to me as a kid. And then I think I went to primary school. I had a very good science teacher in late primary school who was great, really great at explaining things. And he made science really accessible.
Okay.
He made it sound really fun.
Oh, okay.
So I think that kind of installed the bug in me. And then I moved on to high school and I was a bit of a polymath, so I tried taking lots of different subjects,
mm-hmm.
but I think the science ones were the ones that really talked to me.
Okay.
So that's how I think I ended up in science,
And so then fast forward, you're in college. Do you go straight into the sciences or do you kind of dabble in things?
Right. So I am from Europe originally. So mm-hmm. I did high school in my native Cyprus, which for your listeners is a small island in the Eastern Mediterranean. So I did my high school there, and then I went on to the UK to do my undergraduate education.
Mm-hmm.
So I completed a degree in geophysics at Imperial College in London. So I was straight in the physical sciences from the get-go.
Okay.
But there was a bit of a debate before I started my degree on whether I wanted to do straight physics or whether I wanted to do geophysics.
Now, what's the difference?
That's a great question. So physics, generally people would think of it as the study of everything in the physical world.
Mm-hmm.
So physicists will generally dabble in problems, anything from the subatomic level, very small particles, up to the level of things that we can see, so
mm-hmm.
the way that things move.
Okay, that covers a lot. That
exactly.
covers basically everything. Go
yes,
on.
Exactly. But I can tell you that many people who think about studying physics
mm-hmm.
when they're in high school, they will think of physics mainly through the work of Albert Einstein, this theoretical stuff. And that was no different with me. I thought I wanted to do that sort of stuff. But then I discovered that physics, that kind of physics, is very involved with a lot of very high level and abstract math.
Oh, okay.
So I was good in math, but I was not, a mathematician at
uh-huh.
heart. So I discovered through actually taking studies of geography in high school, the geo aspect, the geodimension
okay.
of physics. So I learned about earthquakes and volcanoes in geography class in high school.
Mm-hmm. Everybody loves earthquakes
exactly.
and volcanoes.
They are big things. They
Unless
make a big bang.
To you. Yeah.
Exactly. They make a big bang.
Uh-huh.
They are spectacular phenomena.
Sure, sure.
That really make you feel like small
uh-huh.
as a resident of this planet. And then I kind of pieced things together and said, well, we can apply classical physics to the geo problems that are also very relevant to the world. And that's when the light bulb turned on.
Okay.
And I discovered that there were geophysics courses. So I ended up applying to them and got a place in the UK. And that's how my journey in this field started.
So when you let's just back up a little bit. So geophysics doesn't require a great deal of math, but it does require some, or doesn't require any. What is that?
So geophysicists, we like to think of ourselves as very versatile people. Mm-hmm. We use a variety of tools. Mm-hmm. Math is, of course, one of them, because we are rooted in physics. We are rooted in physical principles. But we are rooted in physical principles that are classical, mm-hmm. in a way that we deal with much simpler physics than what our counterparts, the theoretical physicists, will deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So for anyone who has watched the movie Oppenheimer, we don't do any of that sort of very advanced math.
Okay.
We are much more grounded in simpler physical principles, and then we try to apply them to understand physical processes that happen around us.
Okay.
So I would class myself as a solid earth geophysicist. I deal with things that are underneath our feet with mm-hmm. a solid earth.
Mm-hmm.
There are colleagues who deal with the atmosphere, so they study things like atmospheric transport
uh-huh.
and the way that weather is generated, hurricanes. So we're all under this grand umbrella of geophysics.
I see. So sort of like you get the ground, you get the air, mm-hmm. you know, maybe this person gets the subatom. I get you. Okay.
Exactly.
All right. And I think it seems like since you're working with actual physical things, the math would be more accessible to a regular person as opposed to like a kid could really get into it. I'm not saying that what you do is, you know, child. What I'm saying is a normal person might be able to grasp the concepts that you approach. So let's talk about Earth, and specifically, I saw the word earthquakes next to your name. So is that your kind of specialty?
Exactly. So I am a seismologist, mm-hmm. which is a word that comes from my native language, Greek.
Mm-hmm.
The first word in that word is seismo, for seismos, the word for earthquake in Greek.
I did not know that.
And logist is the expert, so mm-hmm. an earthquake expert.
Oh, I like that.
So I am an earthquake expert.
Okay.
So a geophysicist turned into this subspecialty of geophysics that is seismology, this, mm-hmm. The study of earthquakes. And particularly, I am very interested in studying the way that earthquakes shake the earth at very different locations and trying to understand the patterns that mm-hmm. the shaking takes on over space.
Okay. I have a lot of earthquake questions because growing up in San Francisco, you're always hearing that it could happen any moment. And it's always, you know, sometime in the next 50 years. I'm older than that. So, you know, it's like we're overdue for the big one. So when you are studying earthquakes, first of all, what region of the world has the most earthquakes? And then what region of the world has the most severe earthquakes?
So that is a great question. So we know that earthquakes happen all over the globe,
mm-hmm.
but their distribution in space is really biased towards regions of the Earth that we would call plate boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
So for your listeners, the Earth's outer surface is broken up into tectonic plates.
Mm-hmm.
So those are you can imagine them as pieces of the Earth that are able to move around.
Okay.
And they have been dancing around and moving for millions and millions of years. We know that the Earth has had a tectonic engine, as we call it.
Now, what's tectonic mean?
So tectonic is just a word for that pertains to the Earth.
Oh, okay.
Structure.
All right.
So we call them just plates for simplicity.
All right.
So they are moving around.
Okay.
And at the lines where they make contact with each other,
mm-hmm.
We have earthquakes.
Okay.
Because those plates are trying to move because mm-hmm. they are getting forced by the internal forces of our planet.
Mm-hmm.
But they are physical materials that have friction. So that friction kind of resists the movement
sure.
that the Earth is trying to impose
mm-hmm.
on those pieces of our Earth's outer shell. So that's how we get earthquakes. The pieces are trying to slide past each other.
Mm-hmm. And they can't.
They can't. And then they are building lots of energy up. And there comes a point where the friction between the two blocks is not able to hold them together anymore. And they slide in an earthquake.
Sort of like popping?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And I've seen things like there have been earthquakes where like entire continents were suddenly submerged and entire lakes were formed like within a period of a few hours. Where has that happened?
So that's a great point. So we know that earthquakes happen on these plate boundaries, mm-hmm. as we just introduced. And earthquakes are a very sudden phenomena. So you will have motion of the two blocks of Earth that are trying to move past each other over a few seconds, but on the order of tens of meters in the largest earthquakes. So, for example, in the magnitude 9 earthquake that struck Japan in 2011, people know it as the Tohoku earthquake. That's the earthquake that caused the nuclear accident at Fukushima nuclear plant.
Yeah.
We know from actual direct observations of the sea floor that the two blocks moved 40 meters past each other. So that's about 120 feet of motion over a few minutes in that earthquake.
And that's that amount of water displaced too, right?
Exactly. So that also caused a big tsunami because the seafloor moved very abruptly, and you have the motion of a big column of water very abruptly. It's just a big mountain of water, and it wants to go down because of gravity.
Oh, okay. Talk to me. But you didn't say like where the most are and where the worst are.
Okay, so we know that most earthquakes happen on these plate boundaries. Your listeners might have heard of the Pacific Ring of Fire.
Yeah.
So all around the Pacific, exactly, we live on it. All around the Pacific, from New Zealand all the way up to Japan, Alaska, the coast of the Pacific Northwest. Down into the South American continent, the coast of Chile, we have all of these plate boundaries, which are kind of the same type. We have oceanic plate that is trying to go under the continent, and where that motion gets stuck, we can get very big earthquakes.
So is that like two separate plates? There's that sort of round plate and then the continental plate?
Exactly. So there's a continental plate. Oceanic plate tries to go under because it's generally heavier, denser. Mm-hmm. So it tries to dive under. It gets stuck. And eventually there's enough energy to overcome the friction so that we get the big earthquakes.
So is it moving west to east? Because how does it affect? If it's moving west to east, then I can see how it affects North America, but not the ones that are to the west of it. If it's moving north to south, then I can see how it affects everybody. So how is it moving? Or is it spinning around like a plate?
So it does move in different directions depending on where you are in the world. So, you know, in Alaska, for example, we have a plate that is generally the oceanic plate, the Pacific plate, the Pacific Ocean that we all know. We look at a map. It's moving towards the north, so it's diving under the North American plate there. In the Pacific Northwest, so offshore Oregon and Washington, we have a plate that is moving more towards the east and diving underneath North America.
Okay.
And for example, in Japan, which is on the other side of the ocean, we have the plate moving towards Japan. So it's diving underneath Japan and is having that sort of motion.
Okay. Now, my biggest fear, you know, when you're a kid and you hear there's going to be an earthquake, and like every child has like the major fear that when you grow up, you realize, oh, it's sort of overblown, like quicksand or things like that. Earthquakes, not so much. Then the newest fear is this thing I've heard of with a Cascadia. Tell me about the Cascadia fault or whatever it is, and why I shouldn't be paranoid about it. Or should I be?
So that's a great question. So Cascadia is one of my favorite stories in seismology. It was a great mystery up until the 80s and 90s. So we know that there is this motion of an oceanic plate diving underneath the continental plate, the Juan de Fuca plate, which is part of the Pacific generally, you can think of it like that, is diving underneath the North America. And we know from examples all around the world, from Chile, from Japan, that these sorts of settings where the ocean is diving underneath a continent tend to give us very big earthquakes. However, in recorded history, since the American continent got colonized by the Europeans, we don't really have in recorded history any evidence for an earthquake in Cascadia.
And where is Cascadia?
So Cascadia is up from Vancouver Island in British Columbia in Canada, and it stretches all the way down to Northern California, where you have in Humboldt County.
Oh, okay.
So that's 700 miles of a fault where an oceanic plate is diving underneath North America.
Okay.
But back to our mystery. So why did this region not have a recorded earthquake? But it actually turns out that it did. It was just hard to find. So it took a bit of a detective story to find out about it. So in contrast to the colonizers of the American continent, in Japan, the Japanese had very comprehensive records of earthquakes going back hundreds and hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese recorded a tsunami, which is tends to be associated with these big earthquakes that happen at subduction zones where mm-hmm. an oceanic plate is diving underneath a continent. Mm-hmm. They had records of a big tsunami that happened and struck Japan and caused some damage in Japan in 1700.
Okay.
But they couldn't really match it to their understanding that they knew that there's an earthquake, there's shaking, and then there's a tsunami. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't find an earthquake in Japan that kind of matched that.
Okay.
But then came people who studied deposits in marshes in the Pacific Northwest. Uh-huh. And they found large, thick sheets of sand that seemed to have blanketed large areas of the Pacific Northwest coastline.
Okay.
And then they were able to put a date on those sheets of mud that, again, agreed with 1700. They found lots of trees that seemed to have died in 1700 as well.
Okay.
They were experts in dating tree rings, so to understand when the trees died.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then those dates also pointed to 1700. Oh. So they looked around the Pacific Ocean, and the only evidence for an earthquake that could have caused a tsunami that could impact Japan and create the impact that the Japanese recorded in their diaries was exactly in Cascadia. So all the evidence kind of matched together in this great detective story mm-hmm. to say that there was a big earthquake in Cascadia in January of 1700.
Okay. So this is them piecing it together. It's almost like the smoking gun.
Exactly.
Okay. And so they're sure about this now. So is there a possibility that the Cascadia thing could happen again?
Absolutely.
Oh.
So we know from further work that these people who were dating the mud mm-hmm. have done. Mm-hmm. They have dug deep into the seafloor and they have found more evidence of these sheets of mud getting deposited that are associated with a tsunami that brings out lots of mud on shore. So they have been able to put a date for the recurrence interval, so how often this kind of event tends to happen over time.
Okay.
So they've come up with an answer that's about 250 years, uh-huh. which in geologic time, that's pretty short.
Yes.
And we know that these events tend to happen on average every 250 years, but it's on average. That's the key word.
Okay.
They might happen every 250 years, every 200, every 400.
Okay.
But certainly we're in the window right now.
Great.
250, we're over 300 years past the last one.
Okay.
So we're definitely in the window. But it might be tomorrow. It might be in 30 years' time. We don't really have a way of knowing that to that much precision.
Okay. So the way they're able to determine how often an earthquake comes is through deposits? Or are there other ways that they're able to determine? Like when they look at the big one from 1906 mm-hmm. and we're supposed to be on for another big one, how do they say we're about due?
So that's a great question. One of the ways is using deposits uh-huh. and generally this field of study that concerns itself with finding earthquakes in deep geologic records is called paleoseismology. Mm-hmm. Paleo for old, seismology again, the study of earthquakes. So they're able to use deposits, tsunami deposits for mm-hmm. the big earthquakes that mm-hmm. happen in settings like Cascadia.
Right.
Over here in our backyard in California, we don't really have a subduction zone. Our plate motion is much rather horizontal.
They scrape against one another.
Exactly. It's more horizontal motion. Uh-huh. So you can imagine here in California, we have the San Andreas fault system mm-hmm. that is a strike slip fault system. So we have two blocks that are moving past each other horizontally.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine we are on the North American side. LA is on the Pacific side. So in a few million years, LA will come and meet us from the ocean side.
Wait. Explain that again. Wait, so the scraping of it is slowly pushing Southern California up. So South California will have like a different shape and like maybe LA would be right next to San Francisco. That's nuts. Who thought of that?
But it's a very, very slow process.
But it's nuts. I mean,
it is quite extraordinary to think about. But the fact that we don't really see this process because it's very slow
uh-huh.
makes it quite difficult to visualize. because this process does tend to happen at the speed that your fingernails grow. So
okay.
It's extremely slow.
But one would think that instead of moving, shifting it, it would sort of just grind it away. But you're saying that the plates actually reshape the continent.
So plates tend to be rigid. So uh-huh. They're only scraping past each other and creating all that friction and damage at their boundaries. But far away from those boundaries, we do think of them as rigid plates.
Okay.
So they're pretty much quite robust, solid structures. So we might see Southern California moving up in one piece coming up next to us.
Oh, being like breaking off and then just sort of floating?
It would just float along the conveyor belt that is the big fault.
Oh, okay.
Our plate boundary.
That's crazy to me. I'm still mm-hmm. trying to wrap my brain around
right.
it. So what is your specific earthquake focus in your research?
So I focus more on California.
Mm-hmm.
So at UC Berkeley, where I'm a PhD student,
Go Bears.
We have an app that was mm-hmm. created by a researcher at the Berkeley Seismology Lab
uh-huh.
10 years ago now. It's called MyShake. It is freely available for Android and iOS for smartphones.
Uh-huh.
And we're taking advantage of the fact that all smartphones in this day and age are packed with an instrument called an accelerometer.
Okay.
It is the instrument that is able to tell whether your phone is in landscape or portrait mode.
Okay,
and it rotates your screen.
Uh-huh.
But it is also able to record vibrations. And those vibrations might come from you running up and down or
uh-huh.
going to the gym, or in fact from an earthquake. If your phone is sitting quietly on a table, imagine an earthquake shakes your table in the middle of the night, your accelerometer is able to pick that up.
Wow. Okay, I'm going to have to download that. What's it called again?
MyShake.
Okay, I'm going to remember that. All right, so your phone can just be sitting there and it goes, it's not a truck driving by, it's an earthquake.
Exactly. So we have smart algorithms that are able to distinguish between human activity and earthquakes. And from the records that we get, we are able to do some analysis of those records to try and get to questions that conventional seismic instrumentation that is all over the state at great investment and effort by lots of agencies,
mm-hmm.
but is really not able to get to the density that we can get to when we have all those smartphones in people's pockets, on people's tables, recording and listening out for earthquakes. So my kind of research tries to leverage the spatial density of
uh-huh.
phones in space
uh-huh.
to see if we can see subtle differences in the shaking patterns oh. that we get in earthquakes by leveraging this very big number of recordings that we get.
So how sensitive is your phone? Because, I mean, like, I'm dropping my phone all the time and, you know, it's in any type of orientation and I live in a place that's, you know, gets a lot of wind. So how can it distinguish earthquakes from the sort of the wind or, you know, human interaction?
So that is a great question. We know that smartphone accelerometers are not as sensitive as our very expensive sensors that are purpose-built
mm-hmm.
and put into the ground for that sort of purpose. But we have developed techniques that are able to distinguish. And we also have our trained eye to look at a little wiggle that comes in from a smartphone accelerometer.
Mm-hmm.
And we're able to tell whether it pertains to an earthquake or not. But generally, the point that you raise about buildings
yeah.
is a great point, because we do know that when your phone is sitting on a table in a building,
mm-hmm.
it will not only pick up what the earthquake is doing to the ground, to the earth, it will also pick up the building's behavior. So a great part of what we do is trying to separate those two effects out and see what is coming from the building
mm-hmm.
and what is coming from the earthquake.
Ah, because my building shakes because there's a wind that comes off of Twin Peaks
right.
and it shakes the whole thing. And I don't even think I have bells somewhere, so I don't even think about it. If the bells aren't ringing, then I know it's not an earthquake. But how will your phone know that it's an earthquake versus the wind coming off the hill?
So as I said, we have lots of techniques that are very data-driven. We look at the data.
Uh-huh.
We look at the sort of frequencies, so how often the signal makes a cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And there are characteristics that are unique to an earthquake, and there are characteristics that only come with winds.
Oh.
So we're able to distinguish using
that,
as well as our trained eye. And we now live in the age of big data,
uh-huh.
machine learning, so we're uh-huh. able to leverage these kinds of approaches to help us in our task as well.
And when you have all this data and you analyze it, what will it help you do? What does having this information do for you?
So that is a great question. So we do hope to build up databases that allow us to characterize the patterns in shaking mm-hmm. on a block-by-block level. So we with this very dense data, we hope to be one day able to answer the question, is my block where I live amplifying the shaking more than the block next to me?
Okay.
And we hope to be able to do this at a very high spatial resolution at a block-by-block level, which is not currently what the data that we currently have mm-hmm. is able to do. Now, the implications of that could be quite profound
yeah.
in us being able to enhance building codes that tell us how strong our buildings need to be in order to make those building codes more location-specific.
Right. And and insurance agencies, of course, would want to use them to be able to deny coverage to, like, this block versus that block. So obviously the poor are going to get screwed again, but, you know, that's the par for the course. When you're looking at the vibrations of earthquakes, I know in the old days they used to just think that it rocked back and forth, and then they discovered that, oh, some of them undulate, some of them do this and that. How would knowing about how it shakes affect the block-by-blockness of it?
So that is a great question. So every time we pick up an earthquake record, we seismologists tend to be amazed by how much information it packs.
Mm-hmm.
So as you mentioned, the seismic wave field, so these waves that are emanated from the earthquake that are emitted, they do mm-hmm. travel through earth structure and they get modified by the path that they traverse.
Mm-hmm.
And then we pick them up at our recorders. And then we do know that there is motion that is rocking back and forth in mm-hmm. a horizontal sense. Mm-hmm. We do know that there are rolling motions mm-hmm. as well. And we do know that different locations might pick up a different dominant kind of motion depending on where the earthquake is with respect to that location or what kind of earth structure those waves had to travel through in order to get to our location. And with more data comes mm-hmm. more knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to be using all these big data sets to make us smarter and to be able to speak with more accuracy as to the kind of motion that specific locations will experience.
So for us, like I'll get the question all the time, like, why would you want to live someplace with earthquakes? Because you don't know they're coming. And I'm like, well, you live in a place with hurricanes and blah, blah, blah. But it would be nice to have a lot of lead time to know that an earthquake is coming. What is the furthest out that we can determine that an earthquake is coming? Because it doesn't seem like I'll hear that it's like a few seconds and it's like, well, that doesn't really help anybody now, does it? Just all you have to do is be scared.
So that's a great question. So it does really come back to a fundamental question that a lot of people have about seismology,
mm-hmm.
is the question of being able to predict an earthquake. So whether we can know with high precision the actual date, place, and time mm-hmm. of an earthquake, a question of forecasting where we can give probabilities. Mm-hmm. A number that we like to give is that in the next 30 years, there is a 67% chance of getting a magnitude 6.7 earthquake or mm-hmm, bigger on the mm-hmm, Hayward Fault over mm-hmm. in the East Bay. So that is a number that is statistic. It's a probability-based number. And with the current state of science, we cannot really do any better. However, here in California, we have an earthquake early warning system, which is probably where the fact about the few seconds
mm-hmm.
That you have heard comes from. So an earthquake early warning system works like this. So we have all over the state lots of sensors that are listening out for earthquakes in real time, continuously.
Mm-hmm.
So when an earthquake is already underway, so when the rock has already broken,
okay.
those sensors are able to detect the earthquake. They send the data at very fast transfer speeds, at the speed of light, to a processing center where lots of smart algorithms are processing the data. They're able to determine where the earthquake is,
mm-hmm.
how big it will be, and they're able to make a shaking prediction. And using that shaking prediction, we are able to push out a warning, hopefully a few to tens of seconds before the shaking actually gets to your location. And our app actually is part of that effort.
Mm-hmm.
So the U.S. West Coast, so California, Oregon, and Washington, has an earthquake early warning system that is maintained by the U.S. Geological Survey in partnership with lots of academic institutions up and down the West Coast, Berkeley being one of them. And they maintain the system that issues the alerts. Mm-hmm. But then those alerts have to be delivered to people where they are. So MyShake is an official delivery platform for earthquake early warning in the state of California.
Okay.
So if you want to get the shaking spoilers, if we can call them that, mm-hmm. you need to download the MyShake app.
Okay. Now, have you personally experienced a significant earthquake?
So I haven't really experienced a significant earthquake. I have experienced smaller earthquakes, mm-hmm. and I have to admit that sometimes I have slept through them.
Yeah.
And that really speaks to the lesson that we like to draw from these experiences, is that whether you're actually going to feel an earthquake mm-hmm. does not only depend on the earthquake itself. Of course, you're more likely to feel a larger earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
The further away you are from an earthquake, you are less likely to feel the earthquake. But your personal circumstances will also play a big role in whether you actually feel the shaking. People located in the top floors of tall buildings are more likely to feel an earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
People who are located in areas where the ground is softer.
Mm-hmm.
So we tend to think about Oakland and mm-hmm. the where Oakland Airport is, the marina in San Francisco. The ground is softer and it tends to shake a little bit harder than ground that is hard, like, for example, the Presidio mm-hmm. in San Francisco.
Do you wish you were here for the 89 earthquake?
So that is a great question. So I think there are two answers to this.
Sure.
As a seismologist, just for the experience,
mm-hmm.
but then I tend to remember the fact that the experience was quite traumatic and it was quite a terrifying experience. In an earthquake, you're not going to be able to stand if it's a very strong one.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a bit ambivalent about the experience.
I understand. There's yeah. the seismologist
exactly.
and then there's the person.
Exactly.
Like the seismologist would be like, this is great. And the person would be, I got to get out of
exactly.
here.
Exactly.
I totally understand. So when you've been studying earthquakes, what is something that you learned about earthquakes that sort of blew your mind or burst it wide open? Like, wow, I can't believe that. That's amazing.
Ooh,
That's so interesting.
That is a great question. So I would say it's the fact that has been distilled in my mind that earthquakes are not really born the same.
Mm-hmm.
So that we find that earthquakes really produce a lot of variability in the amount of shaking that they tend to produce.
Mm-hmm.
So when we hear about an earthquake on the news, we will hear a size for the earthquake, a magnitude, that is a number,
mm-hmm.
that might make us think that, oh, there was a magnitude 7 earthquake in Japan and then a magnitude 7 earthquake in California. We might think that those things are pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm.
But that is quite far from the truth, because our Earth is a complicated system, is a complicated planet. The waves have to traverse through much different structures in California
mm-hmm.
versus Japan. So that makes the shaking that we observe quite different. And it's also, even when you think about a smaller area itself, like if we think about a magnitude 5 earthquake down in LA mm-hmm. versus a magnitude 5 earthquake up here in the Bay Area, they might be really different in the pattern that they tend to create
mm-hmm.
in the shaking. And that is, so those might come from a lot of different factors, the kinds of structure, the kinds of rocks that the waves had to travel through.
Okay.
The earthquake itself, how quickly do those blocks of earth move past each other? That tends to make a big difference to the kind of shaking that we observe. And that is really what fascinates me about these patterns of shaking uh-huh. that we observe in different earthquakes. Seismologists, we like to say that in every new earthquake that we observe, we learn something new. Because our field is very young, in fact,
mm-hmm.
it only came about in the 60s, 70s that it kind of got cemented. And then we're learning every day. So there's a lot more to learn, and we're excited to use all these new data sets in order to learn more and hopefully translate that into societally relevant knowledge for people.
Excellent. Now, if there's some parent out there with a kid who's just fascinated right now by earthquakes, is there any are there any books or even for an adult that you recommend that you're like, this is really good, it'll give you a good foundation, or you found it incredibly interesting, or podcasts or whatever?
So I would honestly start from downloading our app, which mm-hmm. is also meant to be a resource for people to get information on how to prepare for an earthquake, what to do during, and after. Mm-hmm. And I would recommend for people to go online on the U.S. Geological Survey's website. There are lots of very good frequently asked questions about earthquakes, all kinds of things about earthquakes. And I would also tell people to go look at the Berkeley Seismology Lab's website, seismo.berkeley.edu. We also have lots of FAQs linked there where people can learn more. And of course, podcasts, you can look at earthquakes on Spotify. I'm pretty sure you can find lots of articles and podcasts about that. The New Yorker did a great piece on earthquakes in Cascadia in 2015 by Catherine Schultz. So there's lots of great resources out there for people to get educated.
And if people wanted to specifically follow your research or your research lab, how would they do that?
So as I said, they can download the MyShake app on Android and iOS. It is free for everybody. And we also have our website, myshake.berkeley.edu, I believe. Mm-hmm. You can Google that. And there will be more information about that. And we're also on Twitter, where we post about times that we alert people for people to understand how our system does in every single case.
Excellent. Well, Savas, I want to thank you so much. I have a million more questions, but we're sadly out of time. But I could talk about earthquakes all day. So thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
All right. People of Earth. Earthquakes. Yeah, I love them. I mean, you know, I don't get scared about an earthquake. Anything under 5 is just like, oh, what was that? At 5, I'm terrified no matter where it is in the grand scheme of things. But love talking about earthquakes, love having scientists on. In a little bit, we're going to be talking about the Day of the Dead at SOMART. So do stay tuned.
21 drums on old beast. Old beast, I don't know what I say. I'm talking about me, I always say old beast and say old bass. I don't know what I mean.
Take two.
21 drums on a old bass horn. And somebody beating on a ding dong.
That's Big Maybell and a whole lot of shaking going on. That, my friends, from the complete OK Sessions, 1952 to 1955. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Who's about to touch your mind right now? Well, the SOMARTS Cultural Center has an annual Dia de los Muertos series of events. Here to talk about it, I'd like to welcome from SOMARTS Cultural Center, Rio Yanez and Bridget Rex. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
It's so great to be here.
I'm so glad to have you. I love, ever since I was a kid, all the Dia de los Muertos celebration. So first of all, tell us a little bit about SOMARTS Cultural Center and like how long it's been around, what it sets out to do.
Absolutely. SOMARTS as an organization has been around for over 40 years, and it has been kind of the home of so many communities in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. As a large warehouse space with a theater, classrooms, two galleries, it has been an incredible resource and gathering place for so many communities, creative artists. I myself, as someone who was born and raised in San Francisco, have been going to SOMARTS events since I was a child in the 80s. Mm. And it is so meaningful to work as a curator there now and bring everyone this exhibit.
What is the exhibit?
So the exhibit is SOMARTS annual Day of the Dead exhibit, and I'll let Bridget tell you more about it.
Oh yeah, so it's now in its 25th year for the annual Dia de los Muertos exhibition, and I'm really glad to be the co-curator this year. And the title of this year's exhibition theme is Bearing Witness, and it's an expression of love, solidarity, and justice for the people of Palestine. And it reflects on the impact of this ongoing trauma on personal, national, and international levels. And so the artists that we have curated have centered creation as resistance. And you'll see anything from more traditional altar setups to sculptures to just entire installation pieces.
Okay. And can you elaborate more, Rio?
Absolutely. So this art exhibit is very much a very modern take on what it means to have a Dia de los Muertos, Day of the Dead art exhibit. We have altars in our exhibit, but they are very kind of modern and contemporary interpretations of what an altar is. You'll still see offerings and loving tributes to people and to things, but it is very much also an art exhibit. And this year, as Bridget mentioned, we are focusing most of the altars on the situation in Palestine, and really, as mentioned before, as an act of love and solidarity and resistance with the people of Palestine, to honor them through these incredibly beautiful altars created by the artist in the exhibit.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the day itself, Dia de los Muertos. Where in the world do they celebrate Dia de los Muertos?
So
at many different places now. It's expanded a lot, I know, throughout the history, right, Rio? It had started in specific places in Mexico, but it has expanded to other places such as Mexico City and all the way across the border over here.
So when you're talking about the rest of the world, is the rest of the world aware of Dia de los Muertos, or is that something that we here in the States are aware of just because we have such a large Hispanic population?
I would say that many different cultures have their own practices of honoring and celebrating those who have passed away. One of the beautiful things about this exhibition is that we are able to bring together so many different cultural interpretations of what it means to to build an altar to someone and celebrate them and honor their lives. And I think that's one of the really beautiful things about this cultural practice. It has its roots in indigenous right. Mexican culture, mm-hmm. but certainly is not exclusive to Mexico. And especially for Bridget and I as Mexican Americans, we have, I think, you know, practice the art and the cultural and spiritual practice of Day of the Dead in a very contemporary way mm-hmm. with this. Mm-hmm.
Well, I would imagine that, you know, as with anything, it evolves over time, and it's constantly changing because people are growing up and they're introducing their children to it, and there's the diaspora of people. So mm-hmm. it makes sense that it would mature and change. Have you noticed a difference in how you guys celebrated the day when you were kids versus now? Like, can you see the shift?
Mm. As a child, I never personally had the opportunity to practice my grief in this way and my culture. And I'm really grateful that there has been more interest in this practice. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Most recently, I personally have my own altar in my bedroom that I keep up year long, not just for Dia de los Muertos. Mm-hmm. And it's really helpful to me because grief never truly leaves you. It's always with you, and that's because your love is always with you. So I have so much gratitude for
it. Okay. How about you, Ria?
So for me, growing up, my family was we're very much cultural practitioners mm-hmm. of Dia de los Muertos. We would have altars in our apartment growing up, and it was something that was very much a part of the culture of the Mission District in San Francisco mm-hmm. For me growing up. And so it was something that I always looked forward to celebrating and to creating and crafting an altar with my family each year. And I think this exhibition is kind of taking that same spirit and doing it writ large in such a expansive and beautiful space like Somar.
Okay. And first off, how long is this exhibition going to be open to the public?
Yeah, it's going to be October 12th through November 3rd.
Oh, that's a nice length of time. And where is Somart's again?
The actual address? In San Francisco yeah. on 934 Brannan Street. Mm-hmm. That's between 8th and 9th Street on Brannan.
It's in that complex that used to have the Bed Bath & Beyond?
It is right next door to that complex
with okay.
the Trader Joe's.
Okay.
It is. If you're going down the street, you'll see it. It's a large warehouse space. It says Somart's in front, and the exhibition will be there. The public hours are Thursday through Sunday. I believe on most days it will be. Actually, Bridget, do you know the hours for the exhibition?
I believe that was. Let me see. It is. I have it up. We have Thursday through Sunday, so Thursday 3 to 7 p.m., mm-hmm. Friday 12 to 7, Saturday 12 to 5, Sunday 12 to 5.
Excellent, excellent. And then after Dia de los Muertos, what are the next plans for the space?
You know, Somart's is, I think, one of the beautiful things about Somart's as an arts organization is that they serve so many different communities. Mm-hmm. So when that show goes out, I'm not quite sure what the next show coming in will be, but they always have two different kind of arts programs running at once in the building, and it's always great to see, you know, what's in their main gallery and mm-hmm. what's in the Bay Gallery where our exhibit is located.
Well, tell me a little bit about your artistic background. So when did you guys, just tell me a little bit about what you guys have been doing in the past.
Sure. I am a curator. I have been curating for 18 years. Mm-hmm. I'm also a visual artist. I'm part of a kind of activist food art collective that silkscreens their artwork on tortillas.
Ooh.
And hands them out at protests and public events as kind of a act of performance art. But for me, my main focus has been on being a curator for the last several years.
Okay, and Brigitte?
Oh, yes, sorry, yes, I'm still here. Thank you so much for asking that question. I am also a curator, mm-hmm. and I have so much gratitude for Rio inviting me to be the curator for the second year in a row for this exhibition. And I'm currently in a curator fellowship mm-hmm. at the Sacramento Office of Arts and Culture in Sacramento, and I'm completing my fellowship this year. So it's been a really wonderful journey after getting my degree in art history and actually getting to use this degree for good and for the betterment of my community.
Okay. Going forward, what's on your agenda?
I would say for me,
Go ahead,
Rio.
Oh, for me, my next exhibition will be a curated exhibition of my mother's work, my mom, Yolanda Lopez, who was a painter, and I've curated an exhibition of her work that will be opening at the Cheech Marin's Museum of Chicano Art in 2 weeks.
Okay, very cool. Very cool. And how would people find out? How would people find out more about your both of your upcoming endeavors and be able to follow you?
Mm-hmm. You can follow me on Instagram at sunqueenxiv, and/or my website bridgetrex.com.
Okay, and Rio?
And for me, I'm very easy to find. You can find me on almost all social media platforms under Rio Yanez, RioYanez.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for being on the show today. And once again, for our listening audience, when, where, and what time for the Dia de los Muertos exhibition?
Sure.
The exhibition unveiling will be on Friday, October the 11th. That's this Friday, from 6 to 9 p.m. There's a suggested donation, but there's free entry for youth under 16 years old, and no one's turned away for lack of funds.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for being on the show today, and I look forward to seeing the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right. People of Earth, this is your opportunity to go check out SOMART's Cultural Center, Dia de los Muertos. October is my favorite month for all things Halloween, Dia de los Muertos. It's just a fun and exciting time. I just want to give you all a heads up for the next month. I will be gone. Mr. Harrison Chastang, our very own news director, will be filling in for me. The interviews will keep coming, and Harrison will be doing it and doing it justice. So I'm very excited. I'm going to go off to other parts of the world, and I'll be back in November. And I hope that throughout you allow your mind to be touched in the way that it should. So until next month, my friends, ta-ta. And toodly-doo.
Agayo.